From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, a look at police brutality. On June 18, 1993, 6 years ago, police in Prince George's County, Maryland, handcuffed Archie Elliott and shot him 14 times. A week after the Justice Department conference on police-community relations, people from around the country will join us for a roundtable discussion on police brutality, as well as a report from Belgrade. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton said today he believes negotiations with Russia on its role in the Kosovo peacekeeping force could reach an agreement in Helsinki today. The U.S.-Russian talks are trying to bridge the gap between Moscow's demand for its own sector for peacekeeping in the Yugoslav province, free of NATO control, and the Western powers' insistence that such a separate zone would risk a de facto partition of Kosovo into Serb and Albanian areas. Leaders of the group of seven richest countries will meet today with Russian Prime Minister Sergei Stepashin in Cologne. Retreating Serb forces today look set to meet a midnight deadline to withdraw from central Kosovo, completing another critical phase of their pullout agreement with NATO. And soldiers of the Kosovo Liberation Army will be barred from carrying their weapons openly in Prizren from midnight today, this according to NATO forces. Meanwhile, another 17,000 Kosovo Albanian refugees have left Albania and 3,000 left Montenegro, taking the total of refugees flooding home to almost 50,000, this according to the UN Human Rights Commission on the UN High Commission on Refugees. The United Nations agency is worried about the dangers for returning refugees of landmines and has called in seven demining teams from Bosnia to begin demarcation of possible minefields. There's also a lot of unexploded NATO ammunition in Kosovo as well. Every day we bring you our daily war and peace report. Jeremy Scahill, Pacifica reporter, has been in Kosovo. Today he reports to us from Belgrade. Jeremy, tell us what's happening.
Well, what we've seen since returning back to Belgrade is a very different spin on what is happening now in Kosovo. The state-run media here is continuing to declare a victory on the part of Yugoslavia, and they've also been putting a heavy focus on telling refugees within Kosovo that are Serbian to remain put there. And what we've seen is sort of a chorus of voices reiterating this. Now you have the ironic scene of General Michael Jackson of NATO, Slobodan Milosevic, as well as members of the Orthodox Church here, all saying the same thing, and that is that they want Serbian civilians within Kosovo to remain put. In fact, one NATO spokesperson outside of a Serbian village told them that only the brave and courageous among you will stay. This as he was talking to a crowd full of Serbian civilians. But having just come out of Kosovo and talked with many, many Serbian civilians, they are disillusioned by this agreement. They feel that their security blanket has been completely pulled away from them. And you see massive convoys of these refugees leaving the country. As we said yesterday on Democracy Now!, it's not just Serbian refugees, it's also Gypsies and Roma people. But they're being prevented from entering Belgrade by the Yugoslav authorities. There is sort of a standstill with these refugees along the border. Now, all of this comes as the KLA is fortifying its positions throughout Kosovo, despite information and statements by NATO saying that they are demilitarizing them. That is still unclear what that means. The KLA seems to be increasing its presence. It plans a major march through the streets of Pristina tomorrow. This comes as the Patriarch of Yugoslavia, of the Orthodox Church, actually moved his home from Belgrade to the Kosovo city of Peć. This as a witness to try to tell people there to stay. But as all of this happens, the refugees continue to flow out. And at the bottom of it is that they don't believe whether it's NATO, their government, or the church saying to them that now the forces that bombed you for more than 11 weeks are going to protect you.
Jeremy, a front page piece in the Washington Post today called The Trappings of Terror talks about the Pristina police station disgorging piles of evidence, tools of torture. And it says that when the soldiers left and the British troops took control of the police station 3 days ago, a bed frame was found with a belt tied to one post, a mattress pocked with bullet holes, heaps of hand-forged brass knuckles, piles of wooden batons, one with the Cyrillic word mouth shutter carved in its side, knives of every side, and mounds of heavy metal chains, and photographs, dozens of police mugshots of women, young children, and men of all ages, all with sad eyes and most with disheveled hair.
That's right, Amy. And yesterday, journalists were shown those scenes at the police station. And also, if you put that in concert with many of the people that we've talked to in the Albanian villages, they do describe being tortured. They do describe terrible things being done to them. What remains to be seen yet is the direct link between those weapons and which forces use them. And that's going to be the question for the weeks and months and years to come, is tying the crimes to the individual people, going through the chain of command, who ordered it, who carried it out. And only then will, I think, people feel like justice is being served, when they know who did what to who and at what time and under whose orders.
Meanwhile, Jeremy, you have returned to Belgrade from Kosovo. What is it like?
Well, actually, Belgrade is remarkably serene right now. The nightlife is returning. People are taking the tape from the so-called Windows 99 off of their windows. You do see people around the streets, and generally people are very uninformed about what is happening right now in Kosovo. As I said earlier, the state-run media here is spinning it very, very differently than the reality we saw on the ground. I think there is a concern, though, over the refugee situation on the part of people within Belgrade. They have family. They know that their family is leaving, and so there's a great deal of concern that those people are not going to be protected, or moreover, that they're not going to have anywhere to go if they eventually are allowed through Belgrade, and they'll live in the sort of refugee camps with horrific conditions that we've seen the refugees living in from Bosnia and Croatia within Belgrade.
There's also a piece in the New York Times today about how President Clinton has approved a covert action program that calls for the CIA to try to destabilize Slobodan Milosevic and other Serbian leaders. Any word of that in Belgrade?
Yes, but we did get those reports earlier. And, of course, that was reported a few weeks ago, something to that effect. But I think people here are expecting some sort of attacks on the government within Yugoslavia, whether that comes in the form of grassroots demonstrations calling for Milosevic to step down or attacks by an outside power. But I must say, Amy, that people here very much feel that Milosevic's grip on power is still very, very strong. And he does have a chorus of so-called opposition groups that seem to be speaking very much the same language that he is. They're not talking about elections until a year from now, when they were regularly scheduled for, and it seems that Milosevic will, at the very least, endure the next year, regardless of what the U.S. policy becomes. People also feel very much in the grassroots movement here that Milosevic is the U.S. man, that they don't intend to have him out of power, but that it's very convenient to have him with a very weakened country, with a very strong grip on power, and one that they can justify any policy with.
Jeremy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Amy.
Jeremy Scahill reporting to us from Belgrade, Yugoslavia, has been in Kosovo for the last week and will head back there again. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. And since I was last here, the presidential race has officially started.
That's right. Al Gore has announced for president. He did it from his home in Carthage, Tennessee. And I don't know if it should tell us something, but one of the first stops he made after New Hampshire in his five-day, well, trip that he is taking and making a number of presidential bid stops, he came to Wall Street. And surrounded by Schwab and the New York Stock Exchange, as well as J.P. Morgan, he told New Yorkers that he was here and that he represented a new century. But there was also protest, and this is what happened at that event. As he was speaking, some people started to blow whistles, and this is how Al Gore responded.
We have built a strong and growing economy. For many of our families, it is a time of first child to go to college, first mortgage for a first home, first regular paycheck, first demonstration. I love this country. I love our First Amendment. Our First Amendment was born right here on this spot. We honor it. Let's give a hand to those who are exercising our First Amendment rights.
And as they exercised their First Amendment rights, the police took them out. I went to find one of the protesters.
My name is Jean Bergen. I'm with the organization AIDS Drugs for Africa. And why are you out here protesting? Because in his position as chair of the U.S. Binational
and
Commission,
I want to extend our prosperity.
Al Gore has been threatening African countries with trade sanctions, severe trade sanctions,
Delta,
if they exercise their rights under international contracts called compulsory licensing to produce AIDS drugs at pennies on the dollar of what it would cost to buy them from U.S. corporations. So basically, Africans are dying because they don't have the money to make the payments for profits to U.S. pharmaceutical corporations. He could change
just
that. He could save the lives of thousands of Africans. When he talks about compassion, we need to ask compassion for whom? When he talks about families, we need to remember that families around the world are dying, and we Americans could stop that.
That was Jean Bergman. She is an AIDS activist in New York, and she and some other activists were protesting outside the Wall Street stop of one Al Gore, who is running for president of the United States. And what she was referring to was this binational commission that Gore heads up along with Thabo Mbeki, and the Africa trade bill, which is something that AIDS activists as well as pro-Africa activists in general have been very concerned about. In fact, Nelson Mandela, when President Clinton went to Africa, said this bill is for your U.S. corporations. It is not for our country. And in that bill deals with these kind of issues, that what it says is that U.S. drug companies are being stopped from selling in Africa because of the generic sales of and production of drugs by African companies. And this is what AIDS activists are very angry about.
Yes, and this protest now has dogged Gore in all three of his first campaign appearances. So I think it's been a brilliant move by the activists to immediately raise this issue to the forefront. And I have a feeling that the United States is going to have to deal with it, because Al Gore is going to have problems in his rallies if he doesn't deal with this.
That's right. It's interesting, Juan, how it's been brought up in the mainstream media. What they're talking about is his style. Is Al Gore too wooden, etc.? Not that we care. The issue is his record. But in the process of talking about his style, the reason they bring up the AIDS protesters is they're talking about how Al Gore is dealing with the protests. And interestingly enough, occasionally a reporter will actually say what the protesters are protesting about. So sometimes style works, you know.
Yes.
Well, one other issue before we go on with the main issue of the day, and that is it looks like some Republican senators have lifted their hold on all of President Clinton's civilian nominees this week. What this is about is people like Larry Summers, who is being put forward as the Treasury Secretary by Clinton, also the controversial appointment of James Hormel, controversial only because a number of Republicans have been concerned that he is openly gay. You know, from now on, I want to start saying, you know, President Clinton, the openly heterosexual president, as we refer to James Hormel continually, as the openly gay man who has been appointed to be the ambassador to Luxembourg. Well, on the front page of Roll Call today, it says Senator James Inhofe lifted his hold on all of President Clinton's nominees yesterday, declaring victory in his battle to force Clinton to inform the Senate before it leaves town that he'll use his constitutional authority to make recess appointments. They were very angry that he had made a recess appointment of Hormel, but the reason he did that is because Republicans had blocked him from being appointed because he is gay. Inhofe has raised concern that it would offend the Catholic population of Luxembourg. Well, what's interesting about all this is that why Inhofe may have actually lifted the hold on all of the nominees is because of an internal controversy in his office that his computer systems crashed because his staff was downloading so much pornography into computers that it crashed the system. This has been extremely embarrassing for the conservative Oklahoma senator. He says it's a personnel matter. He won't talk about it. Gay rights groups like the Human Rights Campaign in Washington held a news conference saying they respect Inhofe's privacy, and he should also respect Hormel's privacy, and that in this country, privacy is something that is important.
Yes, well, and given the nature of needing passwords on any computer system, I'm sure that the senator could easily find out who was downloading the material.
Well, he has not disclosed who it is, who is involved with the staff pornography controversy. The Human Rights Campaign also said at their news conference it's too bad they weren't also downloading the Constitution. But anyway, it's not clear whether those staffers were fired or not, and not clear whether the system's up and running, whether they could disgorge the lewd and lascivious pictures in the computers. But right now, we are going to turn to our main issue of the day. Angry protesters shouted at Chicago's police superintendent yesterday as he announced that officers broke the rules in the shooting deaths of two unarmed African-American civilians. In one of the shootings, an officer shot a 26-year-old woman after the officer mistook the woman's cell phone for a gun. In the other case, an officer fatally shot a Northwestern University football player after breaking the student's car window with a wrench. Meanwhile, in New Jersey, family members of a black man killed by police in a highway shooting were among the demonstrators who gathered at the scene of the killing this week to remember the victim and protest the incident. Police fired 21 bullets at Stanton Crew in the early morning hours of June 2nd. Four bullets struck him. And he died at the scene. And in Prince George's County, a suburb of Washington, D.C., family members of an African-American man killed by police as he sat handcuffed inside a police cruiser are gathering today at the spot where he was killed on this, the sixth anniversary of his death. His name was Archie Elliott III, the son of a judge and a school teacher, died with his hands cuffed behind his back. No charges were filed against the officers. Well, in response to calls from community activists, civil rights leaders, and human rights organizations, the Justice Department last week held a conference on community police relations. The meeting brought together representatives of the civil rights community, law enforcement officials, survivors of police brutality, and community activists. President Clinton chaired a roundtable discussion that included the mother of Amadou Diallo, the unarmed Guinean immigrant who died earlier this year in a hail of bullets fired by officers from New York Street Crimes Unit, as well as the Reverend Al Sharpton and many others were there. At the meeting, President Clinton declared racial profiling morally indefensible and ordered federal agencies to compile data on the race and ethnicity of people that they question, search, or arrest to determine whether people are stopped because of the color of their skin. Now, African-American leaders had called for a summit with President Clinton. He didn't quite go that far. This was a conference held by Janet Reno. It wasn't called a police brutality conference, but President Clinton did attend for an hour on one of the 2 days. And we're going to start our roundtable discussion today where we're going to go out to California and get the latest on the Tyesha Miller case and particularly look at solutions and how people are organizing. We're also going to be talking about cases of police abuse and how people are organizing on the East Coast as well. But we're going to start with Richie Perez, who's head of the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights. And he attended the Justice Department's conference on community police relations. Welcome to Democracy Now, Richie.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you tell us what it was like? A lot of the meeting was off limits to journalists. What actually happened?
The meeting was a very carefully managed session that the President Clinton piece of it was a very small piece. And let me just also say who attended, because I think that's important. Out of the 250 people that attended, about 82 of them worked for various branches of the Justice Department. 70 of them were law enforcement officials. 22 were other government officials. 30 were from the civil rights community, and most of the people were from based in Washington, D.C. So there was no representative from like local grassroots frontline organizations, probably except myself, and Youth Force that had 3 young people there from New York City. Reverend Sharpton, Ron Daniels from the Center for Constitutional Rights, Gregory Meeks with the New York people. There were only 12 community-based organizations present. So this was really a conference that was dominated by Justice Department officials and law enforcement officials.
Richie Perez, we want to hear what actually was said and what in particular was said to President Clinton when we come back after stations identify themselves. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Our guest, Richie Perez, head of the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights. We'll be back with him and a number of other people from around the country in just a minute.
Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Stand clear. Done, man, I talk. You can't stand where I stand. You can't walk where I walk. Wicked overseer, you hot shot, you wanna get pops and be a savior. First show a little respect, change your behavior, change your attitude, change your plan. There could never really be justice or stolen land. Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you wanna follow me.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we take on the issue of police brutality, not only telling stories about police brutality around the country, but how people are organizing, both at the level of communities and also what is the response of police departments. Richie Perez is our first guest, head of the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights, which is based in New York. He attended the Justice Department's conference on community police relations. When President Clinton attended for an hour, who spoke to him?
Well, they set up a round table and they developed a couple of scenarios and asked people around the round table to speak to those scenarios. And Clinton asked a couple of questions as the discussion was going on. Probably the most significant, the two things that I thought were most significant. One is that President Clinton made a point of rebutting Reverend Sharpton before he left, by saying that community policing in New York City had done a lot of good as it was begun under Dinkins and as it is continued under Giuliani. And we all know that the Giuliani administration repudiated community policing and instead has developed an enforcement strategy that's more based on special units like the Street Crimes Unit. But I think the probably the most significant thing that that resounded throughout the conference was a statement by a young brother from New York City, from Youth Force, Graham Shaking, and he opened up by saying, let me tell you about what the life of a black teenager is in New York City. And Clinton was there. Safer had just walked in, but Safer wasn't part of the panel. As a matter of fact, Safer didn't put up.
That's the police commissioner of New York.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so Graham said, if I'm late to school, I'm sure to be picked up by truant officers as I try to get to school. When I get to school, I go through metal detectors, and I'm escorted to my class by armed cops. After school, when I'm hanging out with my friends, we all have to try to avoid the street sweeps. And finally, at night, he said, I've been stopped 3 to 4 times, and we have to avoid the Street Crimes Unit. It's like apartheid in South Africa. If you don't have ID, you go to jail. And that was his statement. Pretty powerful. Clinton was taken back. Everyone around the panel was kind of taken back. First of all, there were no young people here. There were only 3 young people out of 250. So the community in this police community so-called relationship was really not represented and did not have much of a chance to speak, except in rare instances. And throughout the day, people kept coming over to Shaking and asking him questions about did these things really happen, and if they happened, they weren't the way things were supposed to be. A number of law enforcement officials made jokes about the draconian law enforcement policies in New York City, and I was in a workshop called the Excessive Use of Force Workshop, and it was really dominated by law enforcement people. But let me just finally say, Clinton's participation was very little. He asked a couple of questions. He was very folksy. His main thrust, as was Janet Reno's main thrust, was how do we reconnect communities and police, and how do we alleviate tensions? There was no discussion about police accountability at this session, and there was really no discussion about justice as we define it in terms of Taisha Miller case and in many of the other cases around the country.
And we'd like to bring in also Reverend Burnell Butler, who a cousin of Taisha Miller, an African-American teenager who was killed last December by Riverside Police while she was sitting unconscious in a parked car. And we are connected with him by telephone. I'd like to welcome you to Democracy Now!, Reverend Burnell Butler.
Can you
tell us what has been occurring in the Taisha Miller case in the last few weeks?
Sure. First, I'd like to say that we didn't get an opportunity to come to D.C. We wanted to. We talked with Janet Reno's people. They were supposed to be trying to get us a seat around the round table. And after hearing that 80% or 80 law enforcement individuals were there and we weren't, it just goes to show that they wanted to basically minimize the participation of the grassroots individuals and the families of slain individuals. But what we've been doing out here is to continue not to let up, because I heard one of the city officials here say that they wanted us to discontinue our marches. They were going to put the paperwork in. Well, the chief of police put the paperwork in to fire the police officers, and they were hoping that that would bring closure to this issue. But they put the paperwork in the interest of breaking the police policies, but not in the interest of justice.
Reverend Butler, just to explain, the California DA ruled that he would not bring charges, right, against the police officer involved with your cousin's killing.
He did. He made that ruling without even ever listening or taking a physical statement from the police officers. He just looked at a videotape that was furnished him by the police department itself.
And but, yet the police department is going to fire the police officers.
Yes, but right now here in town, we have met with the Justice Department and with Janet Reno's, the U.S. attorney, and they have opened up and it's ongoing a criminal investigation. There has been not just new evidence, but evidence that the district attorney has overlooked or omitted from the case for whatever reason. The evidence that plainly shows that this was a race and a hate crime. The officers, all four of them involved in the shooting, used racial language before, during, and after they killed Taisha Miller that they never asked or tried to find out what was her medical condition, that in fact that the supervisors that was on the scene also used racial language, and he was one of the ones that made comments even about the family later. But this officer is also on leave now at this time, and this was not brought on or even included with the evidence that the district attorney used to make his ruling. And this is appalling, and it angers people when you see all the evidence that the night that it happened, there was one of the officers had a birthday that night. It was his birthday, and the other officers were with him and believed to be celebrating, and they were allowed 8 hours to get the whatever it was out of their systems before they gave them a toxicology. But we know early on that they gave Taisha Miller toxicology and released the results within a couple of days of her being killed, and it took 6 months for them to release the officer's toxicology, and one of them mysteriously, the urinalysis mysteriously leaked out of a bag, supposed to be on the way to the crime lab. So there is so many things. There is information that
kind of redefines police leaks.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that I'd like to ask Richie, which I've always maintained, is that I believe that any police officer involved in a fatal confrontation or a shooting should immediately be put on a drug and alcohol testing, because they do it for conductors of buses. That's or trains, right, or planes, or anyone who's been in an accident, any employee in other form of work. Why not police officers who are able to use deadly force? If they do use that deadly force, automatically should be tested for drugs and alcohol.
I agree with you. One of the problems is that the police unions across the country are in opposition to things like that. And at the conference, one of the issues that arose was the power of the police unions. Even when you find people in police departments that want to discipline bad cops, the police unions operate as a lobby within the police department and can undermine any police commissioner anywhere in the country who really goes after cops seriously and vigorously. So those kind of things, the drug testing issues, the amount of time that they have before they can speak, the police unions play a tremendous role, and police associations play a tremendous role in preventing that from happening.
We're also joined on our Washington studio by Joe Madison. Joe Madison is a civil rights activist and a talk show host on a Washington station, WOL, in Washington, D.C. He's been on a hunger strike since this past February 15th to demand that charges be filed in the 1993 shooting death of Archie Elliott III. Elliott was killed by Prince George's police on June 18th, 1993, exactly 6 years ago today. The officer shot him 14 times while he was sitting handcuffed in the front seat of a police cruiser. Madison has been subsisting on liquid since February, and it's his third hunger strike in 13 years. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Joe Madison.
Well, thanks for having me, and it's good to be with the other guests, especially Reverend Butler, because we were out there in Riverside with the massive demonstration that they've continued and were arrested along with Dick Gregory and Martin Luther King and Al Sharpton and others. And these demonstrations have to continue. It's interesting to hear Reverend Butler say how the police there or the city officials want to stop the demonstrations. They're trying to do the same thing in Prince George's County. Every Wednesday we've been demonstrating because the state attorney, which is the DA, the prosecutor, will not re-examine, reopen this case against Artie Elliott. And one of the things we should tell people, Artie Elliott was only wearing a pair of sneakers, no socks, no shirt, cut-off jeans. That was all. He was searched thoroughly. They didn't even find a wallet or change on him. And somehow, miraculously, he ended up handcuffed behind his back, strapped in the front seat of a police cruiser. He ended up supposedly with a gun that they claimed he stretched from around his back to the front of his lap while still handcuffed and pointed it out the window of the police at the police officers. One officer black, one officer white, one officer saying the window was rolled up. Another officer saying that the gun was pointed out the window, and he was shot 14 times with five of the bullets hitting him in his heart and surrounding arteries. And they won't even re-examine or reopen the case, and these officers never, never went to trial, even though a federal judge ruled that it was implausible that that the officers were firing in self-defense.
And Joe Madison, now that you mentioned that, this whole issue of another area for reform, that this whole issue of second guns that police officers, many of them carry. In 20 years as a newspaper journalist, sure, I've interviewed hundreds of police officers, and they all talk jokingly about the drop gun, right, that most of them carry.
And this
that's
gun,
an extra gun
and absolutely
that, they
right.
can, that they have available to them that is not recorded by the police department in serial number, that they can, mm-hmm, in a situation where they get in trouble, drop a gun on a suspect. And they joke about this. And another area for reform would be the requirement that any police officer who carries a second gun must have that gun registered and the department know its serial number. Have you found any other instances of cases like that, of suspicious shootings like that?
Well, they're all over the country. I mean, as you say, I mean, all one has to do who follows police reports or police beats. It happens all the time. In this case with Artie Elliott, they didn't even fingerprint the gun. Now, what does that tell you? But you see, you know, this is what's happening. Elected officials, and particularly like Clinton, they're getting free rides. When I listened to the young man talk about there weren't any young people around that table, it should have been filled with young people. It is the hip-hop generation, the younger people, who are the primary targets of these driving while black, driving while brown, driving while whatever other than white males that are the victims. They're the ones that are pulled over. It's the poor people in our community who can't defend themselves, who don't have the lawyers or the financial resources. And most elected officials, if you notice, most elected officials are nowhere on the scene when these demonstrations take place and when people are demanding that there be public policy changes to make sure that officers, by the way, not only take a urine sample immediately after an incident like we are describing here, but they should be investigated and questioned by their supervisors immediately after. In the New York cases, what is it? Some of them 48 to 72 hours, maybe even days and weeks. In Maryland and across this country, officers can go days before they're even allowed to be questioned by their supervisors. This is needs to be changed. It is unfortunate that it exists, but it exists because, as the young man said, the police unions have tremendous lobbying organizations, and they lobby hard to put this public policy in place. And this is policy that we as citizens would never be allowed to have. And let me add one more thing. They also are supported by the city. Case in Riverside, Reverend Butler, with the Haywards, or Haywards, I believe. They've had two trials. These people have had to finance their own transportation back and forth to court while the police officers stay in plush hotels, are fed by the state, are brought to the courtroom by the state, are financed in their trial by the state. And here was a man whose son was killed. It was a medical call. He was a chokehold was put on him. He died. And these people had to put a second mortgage on their home in order to finally get justice, as they did, I believe, 2 days ago in California federal court, where they won a $715,000 judgment, which was only one-fourth of what they asked for. But they went to great expense, as most of us do, to try to fight these crimes.
Joe Madison, we're talking about strategies and solutions today. And what you've been doing since February is this hunger fast. What are you hoping to accomplish, and what are your demands?
No, the demand is very simple. That is to either reopen or reexamine the Artie Elliott case. That's simple. That's what we're asking for. And the reason for the hunger strike, the fast, was to try to bring the truth out on this. What happened out there? The federal court said there should have been a trial. The current state attorney is saying he will not reopen this case, no matter who does what, no matter how many people demonstrate. That's what we're trying to do with this. We must demonstrate, I think, now in the streets more than we've ever before. This is a whole new movement that has started, and the demonstrations must continue. They must intensify. We're now seeing black women and brown women being victims in Los Angeles area. I believe 7 black women have been shot in the last 3 years, most recently a homeless, mentally retarded woman was shot simply because she had a stolen grocery cart. The officer said she threatened them with a screwdriver. They shot her dead. Witnesses say that she was not a threat. The Tyesha Miller case in Chicago, a woman is shot because the police officer stops her on a traffic violation and they mistaken the cell phone for a gun. I mean, we must demonstrate, because the most important thing that will come out of this is not only the reopening of these cases, not only the prosecution of these officers, but most important of all, this must be a political issue for both parties, locally and nationally, because the politicians are doing their best in this country not to make police brutality, driving while black or brown or yellow, as a political issue.
Well, Joe Madison, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Joe Madison is WOL radio talk show host in Washington, D.C. on a fast since this past February in the Archie Elliott case, who was killed by police officers in Prince George's County. We're also talking to Richie Perez, head of the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights in New York, and Reverend Burnell Butler, cousin of Taisha Miller, an African-American teenager killed last December by Riverside Police. Now looks like those police may be fired, though the local district attorney did not bring charges against them, and a federal investigation is taking place as well. When we come back, we're going to speak with Jop Kamau, who's executive director of the Police Complaint Center and former police sergeant of Hawthorne, California, who's gone undercover with a video to tape incidents of police abuse. He, a police sergeant himself, and we'll speak with some others as well. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We will be back in a minute.
Black sheep in the country, black sheep in the town. The black sheep doesn't have a half a chance with so many wolves around. You've got to walk with the Black Panther. That's all that you gotta do. 'Cause when you're walking with the big black cat, no wolves will be running you. Black sheep never had a voice in things, never dared to make a sound. But the black sheep is gonna have a voice in things since the Black Panthers come to town. You've got to walk with the Black Panther. That's all that you gotta do. 'Cause when you're walking with a big black cat, no wolves will be running you. Now you claim to be a rooster, but you've slept through the dawn. And I know you to be a timber wolf, for your fangs have bared my bones. You've got to walk with the Black Panther. That's all that you gotta do. 'Cause when you're walking with the big black cat, no wolves will be running. No wolves will be running.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
Yes, and we're joined also, Amy, by Jop Kamau, the executive director of the Police Complaints Center and a former police sergeant from Hawthorne, California. He's gone undercover with a video camera and taped incidents of police abuse. In one incident, officers threw him through a plate glass window, and he captured this on tape. Now, Jop, in my experience as a journalist, perhaps no one is more aware of the level of police abuse and racism within the police departments in this country as the black and Latino officers who have to deal with rogue cops on a daily basis. What sense do you get of an awakening in an increased militancy among black and Latino officers who are increasingly dissatisfied and frustrated with what they see their police departments doing?
Well, I think you can count a large number of African Americans who have stepped to the forefront, maybe not so much as a result of being sympathetic even to the victims, but for their own personal interest. It's very difficult to function as an African-American or a minority police officer in a department that is overtly racist, because what patterns you see in the field with regard to how officers are abusing citizens is duplicated in the station house with regard to promotions, transfers, access, information, and the nature of police work is such that any conduct that an officer engages in can be second-guessed at a later date. And what you find is that officers who are critical of the department find that their behavior is subject to much more stringent criticism. Therefore, the officer who might come and speak up and say, hey, this citizen was abused, the next time he's in an encounter where the police department is evaluating his conduct, they'll say, this officer ought to be fired. Whereas in other cases, you have police agencies that rally around the worst officers. Officers who frequently abuse their wives, get drunk, engage in misconduct in the field, those officers have sanctuary. So the minority officers, albeit that they're coming forward, they're doing so at a price. Many of them are isolated in their departments, they're ostracized, and once they come out, they can never go back. There is a code of silence. They call it the blue wall. There's several other terms for it. Police pretty much stick together in sort of a pack mentality. And in part, the solution to this problem is going to have to come from within the police department. Minority officers, even if they don't do so openly in public, are going to have to form an alliance with existing civil rights organizations and community leaders to provide the kind of information that is critical to breaking some of these cases. And before I finish, just let me say, I want to say how pleased I am to be in association with the people on this show. This is so important because the voices of the people you've brought on this show are often muted, removed from the table, not brought into the dialogue. Oftentimes when these issues are discussed, just as a gentleman was talking about this recent D.C. conference, they don't tell the folks who are most important to be there, the victims, the people who are actually experiencing these sorts of things. And they wouldn't do this on any other issue. But police brutality is such a hot topic, they are trying to keep a blanket over it.
Jeff Kamau, I just have to ask, although we only have a few minutes and a lot more guests to talk to, this story of you videotaping your own case where officers threw you, a former police sergeant, through a plate glass window, how did you end up videotaping that?
Well, what spurred me to do that is my father had been a police officer for 30 years. He was pulled over driving while black, and he was beaten savagely. And at this point, it's more than me just doing it in that encounter. I do this as a living. I do hidden camera investigations of the police. We take the video. We've done Dateline and other shows to show the public that this is part of an American reality. It's not an isolated incident of some poor black kid who's running from the cops. This is a routine, systematic practice by police organizations all over the country.
Well, as we're focusing on solutions today, we're joined from North Carolina by Matthew Zingraf, who's Associate Dean with the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at North Carolina State University. And he's developing a model for the gathering of data on racial profiling for the state of North Carolina. Can you explain what you're doing, Matthew Zingraf?
Yes, good morning. We're taking a look at all highway traffic stops conducted by the North Carolina Highway Patrol. Just recently, our governor, Governor Hunt, has signed into legislation a bill requiring that all information of stops be conducted, or that information be collected, that the information be made available for analysis. We have information already. The Highway Patrol collects a great deal of information on all written citations, written warnings, and searches, as well as use of force. We're using those data from 1998 to create a baseline in order then to examine the data that will be collected starting January 2000. It's a very complex issue here in North Carolina, and the Highway Patrol wanted to get a jump start on this.
When the issue of police profiling, racial profiling, was actually raised by the Presidential Race Commission. Remember that commission that ended up coming up with their results with extremely little fanfare, to put it mildly. It seemed like they just ran away from it. And according to some of the people who were on that race commission, illustrious people from around the country, they had a lot of pressure on them not to come out, for example, against racial profiling. So it's very interesting to hear President Clinton, you can see how the movement has advanced, saying that he's opposing now and he thinks it's abhorrent, racial profiling. But the Race Commission said that they weren't for outlawing it.
What they did at the national level is a little different from what they did in North Carolina. In North Carolina, there were companion bills that were submitted just a few months ago in our House and our Senate that called for this study, and we're prepared to take a look at it. The commander of our Highway Patrol, Richard Holden, believes that profiling is inappropriate, and if it is being used, that it will be addressed.
I want to say that we tried to get on the San Jose Police Department.
Yes.
Unfortunately, we weren't able to get them on
today. Yes, I met them last week.
Also, the Hartford, Connecticut Police Department, where the police commissioner has said that there is a problem with racism in his department.
Yes.
But right now, we're going to move on to another guest.
Yes, okay. We also have on the line with us Paul Hoffman, civil rights attorney based in Santa Monica, California, and chair of Amnesty International's USA Board of Directors. He's worked on cases of police abuse since the 1970s and has taught law courses on international human rights and police abuse litigation. Now, clearly, Amnesty International several years ago began raising the concern nationwide and in some of the major police departments. And at that time, very few in the country wanted to listen to the reports that Amnesty International was issuing. Paul Hoffman, can you give us an assessment of your sense of what's happened in the last few years and how this issue has developed and grown in the national consciousness?
And how police abuse litigation has changed?
Well, I think that there may be, those are two different questions, I guess. In terms of how the issue has taken off, the guests already on your program have indicated that there's another surge of interest and awareness about this problem. The difficulty, I think, though, has been that there have been surges like this before. In the aftermath of the Rodney King beating, for example, there was a national outcry and surge. What I hope is different about this, and what Amnesty is trying to contribute to, is to raise the level of awareness about this throughout the entire world by publishing reports about police brutality within the United States, which say a lot of things that your guests have already said, and have tried to systematically go through a series of recommendations that we hope over time will be accepted. And a lot of them that fit right into the things that people have said, the need for accountability and discipline and investigation and justice in police abuse cases. In addition to the individual cases and the Justice Department's ability to bring criminal charges, for example, there's one thing I'd like to point out that no one's mentioned yet, and that is that in the aftermath of the Rodney King case, Congress did pass legislation in 1994 called the Police Accountability Act. And what that act provided for was to give the federal government the ability to bring pattern and practice suits where departments engaged in systematic abuses, like the abuses that have been referred to about New York that occur in Southern California and many parts of the country. One of the problems that has existed, and I think it reflects the difficult politics of this, is that that's never really been funded fully. The Justice Department has used this authority in a couple of situations, and to very good effect, particularly in Pittsburgh. But they've asked for $1 million, I think, for next year, which is an utterly meager amount of money. And if the federal government was really serious about taking on issues like systematic lack of discipline and investigation, the code of silence, the absence of accountability, racial profiling, the whole list, they should be bringing investigations and lawsuits in cities around this country. And they should be bringing them in cooperation with the local movements and the people that know what's going on in each community around the country. And I think that's a question of political will.
If people were going to call for that to be funded, what is it that they're calling for to be funded?
I think what I think they should be saying is they should fully fund the Police Accountability Act. I mean, that's and the name of the act, I think, is important because that's really the key to this problem, I think, ultimately. And it happens it happens across the country. And this, when you ask about the change in police abuse litigation, there really isn't a big change, and it's because we keep coming against the same kind of situation. And it starts with the fact that inside the department, when an officer commits an act of brutality or treats a person on the street in the wrong way, 99 times out of 100, maybe much more than that, the person's partner, another police officer, the supervisor, is not going to hold them accountable. It's going to be the opposite. They're going to do everything. The system is worked out so that it's going to make it very difficult to bring a civil lawsuit against the person.
It just seems that when police abuse litigation really takes off, I mean, I know in the city it's cost millions of dollars to the city. The city controller came out with a report on what police brutality just economically costs the city, what they have to pay out, and that might be an added pressure on police departments around the country. But I wanted to go back for a minute to Reverend Burnell Butler, the cousin of Taisha Miller, who was killed in Riverside, California, by police officers there last December. Talking about, following up on Jop Kamau, talking about the police departments, I understand in Riverside there's been this protest of police where they're protesting the possibility that the officers will be fired and they're shaving their heads?
Yes, it's been reported that there's about 200 of the officers they're going to shave their heads or have shaven their heads to protest in support of the officers not getting fired. And we are saying that they racially profile us and then they turn right around or they gang profile people. But it is believed that there is an Aryan Nation type gang within the police department. And I believe all the federal government has to do is come and take a picture and document those individuals that have shaven their heads and it's self-incriminating evidence. And I'd like to also add that this Sunday and Monday, Maxine Waters is coming to town to assist us in our protest and to speak out against police brutality in this city and across the nation. Her and Al Sharpton is coming back to join her and others locally, Danny Bakewell and I believe some of the local entertainers from Hollywood area is coming as well to join us in our protest. But these police officers that killed Tyesha Miller had a history of racial problems from high school. I believe one of them was involved in an incident in the National Guard unit that he was stationed in, and it's all coming out now. People that have, since their names have been public, have called in and said, I know this guy. This is the same guy that harassed me and it was documented. So we've given this information and all the calls that comes in, we give the information to the federal government that is here investigating, well, actually the federal prosecutor. So,
Reverend Butler, I just wanted to give our listeners a chance to get down some numbers and websites because there's so many people on the line working on different aspects of police brutality. Matthew Zingraf, let's begin with you, director of the North Carolina Center for Crime and Justice Research, where you're working on this model for the gathering of data on racial profiling. Do you have a website or a phone number that people can call?
My phone number is area code 919-513-1837. We don't have a website about this particular project.
That's 919-513-1837. Joe Madison of WOL, a talk show host in Washington, D.C., who's in the midst of a many-month fast, particularly focused this time on the case of Archie Elliott. You have a website, I understand?
Yeah, matter of fact, you can actually see the report and the photos of what happened to Archie Elliott. www.afamerica, that's afamerica.com, / Elliott, ELLIOTT. Or you can go to our website, www.wolnewstalk.com, and there's a link to it.
And that's Joe Madison of WOL. Job Kamau, as you continue to run the Police Complaint Center in California, what is your number or website?
Our website is www.policeabuse.com. where you'll find video of our hidden camera investigations, and we're doing this all over the country. We just did New York and tested 40% of their police precincts, and we were thrown out 50% of the time when we tried to file a complaint. We were thrown out or given bad information by the officers.
That's www.policeabuse.com?
Yes.
And Richie Perez of the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights here in New York City. Phone number?
212-614-5355.
That's 212-614-5355. And Paul Hoffman, chair of the Amnesty International Board of Directors.
The phone number that people would call would be 212-807-8400, and the website is www.amnesty-usa.org.
That's www.amnesty-usa.org. I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Reverend Brunell Butler, cousin of Tyesha Miller as well, from Riverside, California. Thank you. And that does it for this roundtable on the issue of police brutality and solutions and strategies to deal with it. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Happy birthday, David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Thanks to Joe Gill in Washington for engineering at WPFW. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening. There could never really be justice on stolen land.